and welcome to the International Trade Resource Podcast, your go-to source for insights and information on all aspects of international trade. Whether you're an entrepreneur, a trade professional, or just curious about the global marketplace, we've got you covered. From customs regulations to export strategies, from emerging markets to international finance, we explore the latest trends and best practices that drive global commerce. Our host, Kim Kirkendall, sits down with a diverse range of experts who navigate the complex world of international trade and help you stay ahead of the game. So get ready to learn about the ins and outs of international trade on the International Trade Resource Podcast.
Hello, listeners. We are thrilled to have you back for another episode of the International Trade Resources Podcast. And our focus today is going to be on risk mitigation in your data, especially with overseas partners. And I'm really excited to have a very, very experienced executive in this field and a good friend, Bob Ekman. He's the CEO and CISO for North Coast Cyber. He has over 25 years in IT leadership, 15 of those in security. And his focus is on policy, controls, strategy, from a senior level executive standpoint, all the things you need to really create, implement, manage, troubleshoot a IT and cybersecurity system. So thanks, Bob, for being here.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me, Kim.
We want to start off with kind of a 30,000-foot view of framing. You know, what are some of the situations where companies end up in trouble because they're storing data, sharing data, you know, they're transferring data with their overseas partners? What kind of problems does that lead to?
Yeah, so organizations oftentimes don't recognize the value of their data and what the criticality of that data is. And so they don't have a good sense for where that data is located, how much data is in there, what kinds of data is in there. I've seen situations where data gets emailed from one place to another, and there's almost no understanding of what the data is that's within that email. So, you know, speaking more generically, international businesses really are required to share data. I mean, you almost have to. It's table stakes today to do business across borders and drive really global business operations, enabling expansion, including a broader market, reaching that broader market, increasing partnerships. Think in terms of driving efficiencies and powering innovation. That requires the sharing of information. I think it's really important for us, for the purposes of this discussion, that we kind of hone in on the movement or the transmission of, you know, regulatory control data or highly sensitive data across borders. Now, for the most part, there probably isn't much of a concern for regular data that's moving. Most of the concern seems to be around what I would refer to as personally identifiable information. You hear this in the industry, it might be referred to as PII. Basically, any information that can distinguish you as an individual, think of that as your name, social security number, biometrics as well. We oftentimes overlook, you know, a picture of your face or your fingerprint. PII also extends to other linkable information, such as your place of birth, date of birth, mother's maiden name, anything that could infer you, your individuality. So this notion of highly critical data is really important because highly critical data can, especially as it relates to operations data, so think in terms like manufacturing plants and so forth, can divulge vulnerabilities that could lead to cyber compromises, especially in manufacturing and power generation. My background, I started out my cybersecurity career in power generation, in nuclear power. We implemented the program for cybersecurity for nuclear power plants. And I'll tell you that that data coming off the shop floor is incredibly important, right? So anything in terms of mechanical plants or networks. We also overlook intellectual property. And so I think as organizations begin to think about how they interact specifically with email, because email is so easy, just to draft a note, attach something and send it, not really understanding what it is that you're sending. And so we often hear about some of the effects or ransomware that's out there and data exfiltration. Ransomware, as many of your listeners probably already know, it's a malware attack intended to either lock up data or encrypt it, you know, in some way, and or exfiltrate that data out of the organization, what I would call hold it hostage. There have been a number of organizations that have been met with regulatory compliance issues because U.S.-based data has been either compromised or shipped overseas. or provided to overseas organizations for marketing, not even a hack attack, if you will. According to the New York Times, and getting back to your question directly, Marriott Hotels in 2018 had an attack on the reservation system by what is suspected to be Chinese state actors, resulting in the release of private information of up to 500 million customers. Facebook was also fined for providing data to a UK firm. We've all heard about this one, Cambridge Analytica, in 2010. They divulged the personal data of millions of American Facebook users to Cambridge for political advertising purposes. This data was provided without the consent of millions of citizens. And in 2019, Facebook did settle with the SEC for over $100 million relative to that attack. So I think it's critically important that organizations understand what they're doing with their data and the different technical mediums by which they can share them. Email is certainly probably the most prevalent and probably the most prevalent area where we see compromise, because people do share the information willingly in some cases, but we also see compromise of email accounts. And when an email account gets compromised, basically that means the credentials for that user got compromised, the username and password. That compromise can lead to access to every email that you've sent, every email that you have, communications within your firm, and so forth. Shared drives also present a huge vulnerability because shared drives allow us to store large amounts of this data and then share that data with other users. Typically very difficult to manage the access to that data. We are seeing, though, that cloud solutions like Microsoft Azure Environment or Google or AWS have included now better controls for sharing information. In fact, you know, the example earlier about using email to share a file as an example, a lot of people don't know that you can actually use the cloud to share a file instead of actually sending the physical file through the internet to that user. We have to understand that that email hits on a number of servers as it moves throughout the internet. And each server that it bounces off of, each mail server it bounces off of, it leaves a copy of that email. So if you send a clear text spreadsheet, let's say attached to an email, and you don't encrypt that in any way, in other words, lock it up with an encryption mechanism or algorithm, and you send it, it will be clear text sitting on all of those mail servers and available to hackers who have bots that crawl through those mail servers looking for things like payments or invoices or whatever the case might be. Point being is you can sometimes very, very easily just right-click on that file in your Azure OneDrive environment. As an example, I do this in many of the mediums, right-click on it and share it directly with a link directly with that user. Now you have complete control. You can even denote in that sharing what kind of access that they might be able to get access to. ERP systems reflect a much different environment, operating environment for companies for us. ERP systems are challenging because, let's face it, they pretty much are the brains of your organization. They have pretty much all the information relative to, you know, everything related to the enterprise. At the same time, we're seeing now a push by enterprise resource providers that these solutions are now moving to the cloud. And SaaS is becoming a much bigger player in that space. And in fact, I just heard recently that some ERP providers are not even allowing for on-prem licensing anymore. They are forcing their clients to go to the cloud. What that means basically is that you need to gain a better understanding of what data you're storing there, where it's being stored physically, the location of it, and who has access to it. So these are all kind of considerations that I think organizations need to have, Kim, as they think about how they're going to interact with technologies, most specifically with organizations that are overseas.
That's a great, great introduction. And for the listeners, I'd like to highlight a couple things as we lead into the next question. One of the very first things you said is that the main issue is the organization doesn't recognize the value of their data. Later in this podcast, we'll get to what the organization can do. And I think training and awareness has to be a big part of that. And then you mentioned, two kind of key issues, the regulatory controlled data. So data that the government of the country you're in or the countries that you're sharing data with might control. And we don't have it as much in the US, but it's much stronger in Europe with GDPR and in China with PIPL and other countries. The second one was company critical data, right? The results of your testing, diagrams for your equipment, metrics on how the product's performing. Those are all things that somebody might be interested in. Then you kind of segued into, the ways that companies are attacked. the data is held hostage or fees are charged, or they just sell your data, right? I mean, those are all things they can do. But our next question is really on what are some of the ways they can protect their information? And you mentioned, you know, the main vulnerabilities are email, shared drives, and ERP systems. So in those three things, how can they protect a company protect their information?
Yeah, so the absolute best method, I like to say that encryption is our friend. Encryption is a process, think of it as an algorithm. And the algorithm, basically what it does is it takes your file, let's say it's a Word document, and it essentially applies a key to that file. It runs it through something called an encryption algorithm that essentially spaghettifies, think of it as shredding a document through a shredder, spaghettifies that data to a key. Then that data is shipped, you know, transmitted through the internet. Sometimes it's through email, could be through a shared drive of some kind, wherever it might be, a database. It's shared with another entity on the other end. Now, that entity, in order to view that data, needs to have either that same exact key you're using, that's symmetric encryption, that means same key both sides, like looking in a mirror, right? Or asymmetric, which is a computational model that creates a secondary key that is different, but related back to the primary key that was used to develop the encryption to begin with. Once that shredded, spaghettified file, I like to call it spaghettified because it's essentially what it looks like, it's just a convoluted mess, arrives at its destination, the receiver can then apply that key and essentially run that file through the decryption algorithm. It's essentially the encryption algorithm. It just runs backwards. And the key is applied to basically put that file back together and make it clear text again. That method is absolutely your friend. And it is highly suggested that your encryption methods be at a level sufficient to make cracking of that encryption key very difficult to do. Hackers love short encryption keys. Think of them as short passwords. The shorter your password, the easier it is to crack, just like a safe. Someone's going to crack a safe, the easier the combination is, the faster they're going to crack it. So many of the main cloud providers, such as Microsoft, Amazon, Google, and others, use encryption standards that require a very long key and very advanced algorithms. We refer to these oftentimes as what we refer to as advanced encryption standards, or AES. And then the bit of the key, the length of the key, essentially, that's considered a standard in our industry is 256. So what you'll hear, this language that you'll hear as you're talking through contracting or discussing things with your SaaS providers, your software as a service cloud providers, is, you know, does your encryption standard meet AES 256 or better? Companies should require at least this standard when encrypting their data. It's most especially for overseas storage or transport. Understand that some countries like China and others may require access to encryption keys for information providers or for what they refer to as network providers within the China cyber law. But there are many laws throughout the world that require similar access. Just understand that by using cryptographic tools in any way, you could be violating international cyber laws and potentially even export control laws as well that say if the technology that you're using, the cryptography that you're using could have a dual use, potentially it might be in violation of export controls. Another huge area that I promote quite a bit with my clients, Kim, is data minimization. So first off, know what your data is and know where it is. So knowing what your data is a process we call data classification. And that's where essentially you think in terms of all the data you interact with as a business, and you classify it high, medium, low. You could even have a critical moniker if you like. And essentially you identify and classify your data according to that approach. And then for each one of those, you identify the acceptable ways to interact with that data. So think of it in terms of, can I email this data? Well, if it's low, probably. Low meaning it's directory level. I can Google that information if I need to. Or perhaps it's high or critical data, in which case we might say, no, you can't email that. Here are the acceptable ways to share that information. Again, we call that data classification. Another process that's oftentimes attached to data classification is called data governance. And what data governance is essentially control of that data by the business. Data belongs to the business, folks. It doesn't belong to IT. It doesn't belong to security. It belongs to the business. And oftentimes to the clients and stakeholders that business represents, the customer. And so it's critically important that the business interact with that data from an ownership perspective. And that's essentially what data governance does. It assigns a data steward and a data security administrator over the various types and classes of data. And then the other area I like to focus on is data minimization. Very good practice. What does this mean? If it's not needed, delete it. It's kind of like cleaning out the junk every spring. Ensure that if the data is in the cloud, that it's deleted forever. And what does that mean? That essentially means that when you delete that element from your share drive, your cloud drive, your SaaS provider, wherever it is, it's also deleted in the backups that sit out on various servers as well. Very important element, ensuring that you shrink your data footprint as much as possible. Ensuring you have just one system of record. Try not to create copies of your system of record data. Force users to go back to the system of record for that information. Monitor and control their access to that system of record. Another area I'd like to touch on, if I could, Kim, is understanding contracts. This is probably the biggest area of focus that security and IT people should be working with our business partners. Many software providers are now forcing customers to the cloud. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of ERP providers are doing that. Ensure that you have a cyber lawyer review of those contracts, specifically SaaS contracts. They should ensure that the cloud provider adheres to any regulatory requirements that you have to meet as well. Also, make sure that they're respecting the laws of the country from which the data may originate and of the country to which the data may travel through and or be stored. And so they can review the contract from that perspective to ensure all those elements are being met. And know where your data is going to be stored and ensure you know who has access controls to that data. Cloud providers should have tools that allow you to monitor the locations and access to your data. Ensure the contract outlines the parameters and instances whereby, as an example, let's say it's an ERP software as a service provider in the cloud. You should know when they need administrative access to that data. Ensure that these persons can't, you know, just copy the data. And if they do for administrative purposes, which happens sometimes, that the source and destinations are known and pre-approved by you. So you know where that data is going to be sitting and residing while they're working on it. In some cases, providers will allow a process where they have to request access. Microsoft has a tool called Lockbox, where they actually have to go and grab a key from you and that you grant to them in order to do administrative work on your systems, on your cloud-provided systems. So all of these, I think, Kim, are methods and modes. I mean, there's probably, we could honestly do an hour and a half on ways to protect data. But I think these are some of the key elements that if people really focus on these four or five things, they're probably taking the right steps.
And before we move on, because I mean, this has been extremely, extremely useful. And I mm-hmm. know our listeners, you know, are this is not their field. Mm-hmm. They're learning a lot here about how they need to engage with the cybersecurity and IT teams in their companies to make sure that they're not contributing to this problem. But you briefly mentioned using crypto tools can violate export bans. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I know a little bit about export controls in terms of cover software, which is something I don't think people understand. You know, so if you're exporting software, that software sometimes falls under, you know, ITAR or one of these other, we're speaking U.S. here, one of these other government regulations. Is that what you were mentioning? Is that what you meant?
Yeah, essentially, I think we need to recognize that the United States views the movement of information across borders very differently than perhaps a number of other countries do. Most countries view access to that data as being key and elemental. And let's be very clear here. Export controls apply to ITAR EAR requirements, so the international trafficking of arms. So as an example, a company that makes munitions is a good example of that. Or EAR, which is export controls, which is really any technology that could have a dual use. So although it may have a civilian use, you know, to be a really good encryption engine, as an example, it may also have a military use for that receiving country, in that it may provide them cryptography tools that they don't have today that they could use in warfare, just as an example. And so I think as a country, we need to recognize the importance of these laws and ensure that we're adhering to them. And so the recommendation is that, specifically as it relates to cryptography, that you check your what's called the ECCN, which is a classification number for export controls, and ensure that the technology you plan to transfer, whether it be the software package or tool or the language that it's written in, isn't under the ECCN control. And understand that in the United States, it's not just so much the access, it's the movement of that information. So even if there isn't access to that information, you still have to assess it for export controls, which is a very different way of looking at things. We have seen real live indicators that the government is obviously watching export controls very closely, as they should. And I think organizations are becoming more privy and understanding better the requirements relative to that. I would highly suggest if your organization works in that space, or if you're not sure if your organization works in that space, I would highly recommend that you get with an export controls lawyer or someone who specializes in cyber or data transfer and have them review your contracts and the solutions that you're providing to ensure that, you're within guidelines.
That sounds great. I do a lot with import-export and export controls.
You do.
And I think there's a lot of times companies just misunderstand what products can be covered. And I think the fact that software is covered is surprising to a lot of people.
Yeah.
You've given us some good examples of, how these fraud situations can happen. You talked about, they're using your passwords or they're getting company data. So what are some of the other ways data can be used to damage your business that are not on most people's radar?
Yeah, so I think that, we talked about the Marriott breach earlier. We talked about Facebook certainly using this data in ways that they shouldn't. I think that, laws are coming on the books now. We're seeing more and more international privacy laws as well as state-based privacy laws that are requiring organizations to, get better control of how they interact with personally identifiable information. That seems to be the primary focus. Mm-hmm. Of ensuring, a data subject's control of their information and their privacy, that their confidentiality be maintained. And I think the challenge that organizations have primarily is anytime data isn't within your physical control, such as sending an email or storing data in the cloud, it's always at risk for data theft. It's easier for me to control access to something that's sitting next to me in a box than it is something that's sitting at somebody else's house. And I don't even know where that might be, as an example. Some of the data that's most common as it relates to data theft is customer records. Those seem to be primary, invoicing, anything related to payment. So financial data of any kind. Source code really is another, we discussed this recently, Kim, at that town hall that we did, that source code really is the heartbeat of your software. Even if you're a mechanical device developer, let's say you make, heavy earth-moving equipment for the field, but your company has developed a piece of proprietary software that now attaches to those vehicles in the field, the devices on those vehicles, so that you can monitor those vehicles remotely, know when they need maintenance, do preventative maintenance, get all kinds of really great telemetry off those assets in the field. The challenge that we really have is that source code, if you provide it to another organization, you're essentially giving away the keys of the software, if you will. They can take it, they can manipulate it and work with it. So just to make sure that when you're developing solutions like that, you design security and privacy into them. You don't capture more data than you need to capture, which is absolutely key. Remember something. The adversary needs to gain access to the environment and get their hands on the data. This could simply be, finding a trove of data and pulling it out of an organization, call it exfiltration, or bartering and trading for that data. There is a huge marketplace for source code, data, PII out on the dark net. There are literally billions of usernames and passwords that sit in a list out on the dark net. The dark net, think of that as internet sites that none of us know exist, that exist. It's kind of like dark matter in space. You really can't see them, but they're definitely there. In fact, most of the internet is actually dark net. And adversaries, hackers love to play in that space, and they use this information to barter with one another. And quite frankly, the mere perception that you've been infiltrated or that your network or cloud environment has been compromised in some way may be enough for a hacker to, essentially ransom an organization. And quite frankly, the consequences don't necessarily just stop at the ransomware payment. These could also include, follow-on lawsuits, which I've certainly seen in my career, from customers and vendors, recovery costs, reputational damage, fines from regulators. Another big one that organizations tend to overlook, I was working with a manufacturing firm that I was helping them understand that downtime was one of their biggest enemies. And we found that out because we reviewed their contracts, and their customers basically said that for every day of downtime, they owed each of their customers millions of dollars. It was ridiculous the amount of money that was involved. So understand your contracts and the downtime associated with that, because ransomware can cause a downtime. And quite frankly, anytime you have a business interruption cost like that, the insurance industry has recognized that that's a 4x multiplier on your cyber ransomware event insurance claim. So if you were to claim an event, insurers are basically saying that anytime business is impacted, you know, it basically increases the cost of the claim by 4 times. So ensure that you're thinking in terms of business resilience. Review your mission critical functions, what's critically important to you as an organization, make them redundant, make them reverse, and make them diverse rather, and make them available so that in the event you have a ransomware attack, you're still able to keep the lights on for your family.
Well, you're starting to get into our next question. I'm sorry. Oh, no, it's okay. It's okay. Before we do that, I do want to mention to the community that I had a client about 7 or 8 years ago that called me up and they said, Kim, we've had the strangest thing. You know, our primary supplier in China, who's, you know, become a close personal friend of ours, their daughter was in college in the U.S. and I had dinner with her recently. And she asked me if the company was struggling financially, that her father was concerned about me. And I said, what are you talking about? And she said, you haven't paid your invoices for 6 months. So he called to tell me this. And he said, but we have paid our invoices for the last 6 months. What are they trying to do? Well, sure enough, someone had gotten into the email communication between the two companies, spoofed the emails, and was sending new bank accounts that payments should be made to. So the U.S. company was making payments to these other bank accounts that were offshore, because whoever was doing this was in India or wherever, because they had access to bank accounts in Hong Kong and other countries, or Russia. And so they sent more than half a million dollars. And what's interesting about this, number one, is that when you have a good relationship with your suppliers in China, they'll let you not pay for $500,000 for 6 months.
And they're good for it.
They're good. Their biggest concern is something's wrong with you. Like they're worried about you, right? The guy wasn't mad. He was like, are you okay? I'm worried about you. Mm-hmm. But so that's where it gets into these systems of, you know, if the supplier wants to change the bank account, do we have protocols to make sure that that's a valid request and not fraud? So why don't you give us more as we wrap up here? We got about 5 minutes. Why don't you give us more about what are the 5 things, you know, or 4 things or 6 things, it's up to you, that every company should be doing to protect data that's being shared overseas?
Yeah, first and foremost, protect your credentials. And what do I mean by that? The credentials are the username and password to log into a system, typically your Windows environment, Active Directory environment, to be more specific. Ensure that your credentials and your password specifically are complex, long enough, include uppercase, lowercase, special characters. Ensure that you're proactively checking those passwords to ensure like the user can't just reuse a password or change one digit for the next password. Make sure your employees are trained appropriately not to use similar passwords or same passwords to use at work in any other space. So like, don't use, you know, Mead1 at work and Mead2 on your Facebook page as an example. And then finally, ensure that your users understand and are aware of the symptoms, perhaps the indicators that their credential has been compromised. One of the best tools for indications of compromise is multi-factor authentication. If I start getting SMS text to my phone that is asking for a code to log into a system like my Facebook page or my work email, for that matter, I know there's a problem because that's not me doing it. The second thing I'll say is protect your email systems, protect those users' emails. Block spam. So when I worked for a university, we had literally, you know, 50,000 active users at any given time. We would receive literally hundreds of thousands of spam emails on a daily basis. We turned on, and I'm not advocating Microsoft, just saying we used Microsoft's spam blocker. They're basically Office 365 Defender product, and it literally reduced our spam by 80% almost overnight. Scan incoming emails for attachments. Ensure that those emails, any URLs in those emails and those attachments are being detonated in space before they arrive at the inbox. Adversaries love to use that method to deliver malware to basically, you know, keystroke the employees so that they can pick up their passwords or things of that nature or get malware into the organization. Use that AES 256 encryption where needed, understanding that, you know, when you're encrypting in Microsoft, as an example, I said one good thing about them, I'll say one detraction from them. They encrypt Office solutions very well. So if you attach an Excel, Microsoft spreadsheet, or a Word document, PowerPoint to a Microsoft email works beautifully to encrypt that when you hit encrypt. However, we need to be aware that it does not encrypt PDFs. Now, a lot of people don't recognize that you're sending the emails encrypted, but the attachment may not be. So ensure that your email solution encrypts everything. Verify sender and receiver authenticity. A little bit more technical in this space, Kim, and I apologize in advance, but make sure your IT and security teams are using something called sender policy frameworks. And another one that's called SPF, another one we refer to as domain keys identified mail or DKIM. What these are intended to do, and I won't get into the details of them, is basically authenticate the sender of the email so that as you're receiving it into your email system, it's saying, yep, we know who that user is, we know who that IP is, we understand we've trusted them in the past, or not. Train your employees on what to look for. This is like the number one thing. Like, make sure your employees know who the sender and receiver of that is. Oftentimes, they don't. Protecting cloud is a very big topic, but essentially, we've talked about many of these. Encryption is your friend, right? Use it AES 256, ensure you have those keys in place. Understand your contracts. Make sure your legal teams are reviewing those. Know where your data is stored. Know who has access to it. Understanding that ownership of that hardware is essentially ownership of that data. So even though you may have a licensor ownership of that data, someone actually physically owns the server somewhere. What's happening to that server after they decommission it? And make sure SaaS solutions are really notorious for using cheap storage. Sometimes that storage may lack security. Hold them to method. Another area I'd like to touch on, if I could really quick, is social media. Understand that what you post is immutable. Have a good social media policy for your employees, for your environment. It's posted. It's there forever. It's almost impossible to truly delete. Employees can use personal social media that can affect your business as well, some of the things that they may say or do. Establish that policy that provides those expectations. Understanding who controls your social media sites, most specifically during a ransomware attack or a cyber incident response, who's communicating with your world and how are they communicating? There was a breach of a university where the university didn't realize that the hackers also compromised their social media sites. As they started using it to communicate with their staff, the attackers usurped it and essentially gave the staff a bogus link to go to log in. And again, just keep those issues in mind. Data protection, and we've talked about many of this. Know where your sensitive data is located. There are tools that can scan your environment looking for that. Manage your devices where that sensitive data resides. It should have those devices, be it servers, laptops, desktops, tablets, phones, whatever they are, should have a higher level of security than the rest of your organization, right? Encrypt and manage access to backups and monitor your data stores where they sit. Use VPN where appropriate. VPN is a virtual private networking tool that essentially creates an encrypted tunnel between me and my office, as an example. Use those where appropriate, understanding that it is an encryption technology and may run into counter to some international laws. Just be aware of that. And then finally, my last piece of advice, Kim, is know your regulations. Consult with a cyber expert. Make sure that person is certified, has the scars like I do, the experience, and or a cyber lawyer. Really, they can help you understand your compliance postures. And perform compliance assessments. Identify your gaps, identify your risks, and implement security controls to reduce those.
Wow, fantastic. You know, it's just so much information. I think our listeners are going to have to go back and listen again.
They might have to. Yeah, they might want to.
They might have to go back and listen again.
Or reach out to me if I can help.
Yeah, you can see me here, like the audience can't see me, but Bob's seen me here furiously scribbling two pages of notes.
I'm sorry.
To get ready for the show notes when this episode comes out. But thank you so much. And people can find you on LinkedIn.
They can.
Robert Ekman and ECK, and they'll see that in the show notes. And then also, is there any other way you'd like to give them to get a hold of you?
Yeah, they can email me at rwe@northcoastcyber.com.
Okay, great. So yeah, if you're feeling a little nervous after this episode, thinking, are we protected? Then this is one of the people you want to talk to. All right, listeners, thank you so much. And we look forward to having you join us on the next episode.
That's all for this episode of the International Trade Resource Podcast. We hope you found this discussion insightful and informative. To find more episodes and more information on all things international trade, check out our website at www.intltraderesources.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and leave us a review on your favorite platform to help us spread the word. Join us next time for more exciting insights on the global marketplace. Until then, keep thinking globally.